Good evening. I'm Jeff Bennett.
And I'm Amna Nawaz. On the NewsHour tonight, former President Donald Trump's record win at the Iowa caucuses solidifies his hold on the GOP. A look at the tough road ahead for his Republican challengers.
Israeli leaders increasingly disagree in public over the best path forward as the war drags on for more than 100 days and the international community works to get more aid into Gaza.
Our bodies are ill. My children are ill due to lack of food. This is not enough.
And a new law capping the price of insulin brings relief for some people with diabetes. Why the cost remains high for millions of others.
Welcome to the NewsHour. The focus of the Republican presidential race now moves to New Hampshire after former President Donald Trump's record-setting win in last night's Iowa caucuses.
Trump dominated his rivals by 30 points, winning all but one of Iowa's 99 counties. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis came in second place with 21% of the vote, followed closely by former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley. I'm joined now by Republican strategist Kevin Madden, who advised Mitt Romney's 2008 and 2012 presidential campaigns. Kevin, welcome back. It's good
Great
to see
to be
you.
With you.
So I want to get your take on some consternation around how early the call came for former President Trump by the Associated Press last night. It came just a half an hour after those caucuses first began. A lot of Iowans hadn't even voted yet, but the Associated Press put out an explanation today. Here's what they said. They declared Trump the winner of the caucuses based on both an analysis of early returns as well as their AP vote cast, which is a survey of voters who plan to caucus. Both, they say, showed Trump with an insurmountable lead. Kevin, they make these calls when the math lines up. They've been doing it for 170 years. Is the criticism warranted, you think?
You're right, first of all. Every campaign I've ever worked on, we've seen these type of early calls, and you would think that campaigns would be used to it. But we also have to be very cognizant of the fact that there is a very high sense of distrust among a lot of Republican voters and a lot of Republican campaigns, and that's what's driving that level of consternation. So I think we all know that the AP has rigorous standards and rigorous protocols with how they announce this. But I think the media does have to have a little bit of self-reflection about whether or not there is a great utility in answering or releasing the calls so early when you still have people voting, especially in an age of the smartphone where everybody has a supercomputer in their pocket inside these caucuses and they're able to see that type of information while still voting.
Let's take a look at the results from last night and how Mr. Trump did win so big. He dominated pretty much every demographic group. In entrance polls, however, Iowans were asked what candidate qualities were important to them. For people who say that they wanted someone who, quote, fights for people like me, 82% of those folks broke for Mr. Trump, 10% for Mr. DeSantis, 5% for Vivek Ramaswamy, who since ended his campaign, and 4% for Nikki Haley. Why do these numbers stand out to you?
Well, first of all, I think one of the things that we are seeing right now is the emerging view of the emerging worldview of Republican voters. And one of the first things that they're looking at right now is, can somebody win in November? And what's really emerging about the electability argument is the idea that somebody is out there fighting for them. And so that is a very, very, I think, potent argument that many Republican primary voters are seeing right now. And it's why this air of inevitability is sort of, kind of coasting around Trump right now. Mm-hmm. I think one of the other things that's very interesting is if you look at general elections, many close general elections sort of live or die on that question. Which candidate understands or reflects the principles of people like me? And so I think for a lot of the folks that are watching this from the White House, from the Biden campaign, they see that number as very high and very potent with Republican voters. I think it creates a very difficult general election matchup for them on the very similar question.
Let me ask you then about that, what's become the fight for second place here. Mr. DeSantis really banked it all on Iowa. He finished well behind Mr. Trump, slightly ahead of Haley, but he headed right to South Carolina, to Haley's home state. Here's part of what he had to say in Greenville.
She was governor here for 6 years. Can you name major achievements under her tenure? I mean, tell me if there are.
So Haley, meanwhile, released a new ad today. We should also say she was saying she would not participate in the next debate unless Mr. Trump took part. He was not going to take part. ABC has now canceled that debate. But she's really presenting herself as the alternative to Trump and to President Biden. Here's a clip of her new ad.
Both are consumed by chaos, negativity, and grievances of the past. The better choice for a better America? Nikki Haley.
Kevin, those are very different messages. They're punching in very different directions here. How are those arguments going to play out?
Well, one of the big challenges DeSantis has is that his argument, which is focused on Nikki Haley right now, is a very defensive argument, right? And he's also in a state where he's almost skipping a number of other big primary states between then and there. Not playing on the stage in New Hampshire while everybody else in the attention of the political media and both other candidates is in New Hampshire, you know, that does create a void, I think, for the DeSantis campaign. Haley has had a sort of prepackaged strategy coming out of Iowa, which is no matter what, she's going to say, this is a two-person race between me and Donald Trump. And she's sticking to that strategy right now. And so that is where I think we're going to see these messages go from both of these campaigns. One other thing I'd note, too, is that Haley also believes that the best way to make the case to a lot of Republican voters is to show that she'd be the best candidate, again, to take on Joe Biden in a general election. So that is a key component for her message with not only voters in New Hampshire, but all these other primary states. You look at March 5th and March 19th, where a big chunk of delegates is going to be at stake. That's also her message to those voters as well.
In the meantime, the GOP field has tightened even further. Even since last night, we mentioned Vivek Ramaswamy has ended his campaign. So has Asa Hutchinson. But there's still no consolidation around a single Trump alternative. I want to share with you what the editors at the National Review wrote overnight. They said the party has better alternatives, but if the Iowa results are any indication, perhaps not for very long. Kevin, has that window to consolidate around someone else, has it closed?
I think it's still open, but everybody's certainly running out of time. I mean, we're talking about 1% of the delegates that are at stake were waged last night. But there is a very real sense of inevitability here. And if you look at the picture of what GOP base voters were saying in Iowa, as a precursor for what we're going to see from GOP base voters elsewhere, it paints a very compelling argument that the party and many of its base voters are coming to terms with the idea that Trump is going to be their nominee. Inevitability, I think, for Nikki Haley and Ron DeSantis, that's a very, very tough message to fight against. They have their work cut out for them.
All right. Kevin Madden, good to talk to you.
Great
Thank
to be
you
with
so
you.
Much.
While the first contest of the presidential campaign is over, the race for the GOP nomination and the delegates who will vote at the Republican National Convention this summer is only just beginning. Domenico Montanaro of NPR is here to walk us through the long road ahead. It's good to see you, friend. So we know that 40 Republican delegates were up for grabs last night, and they were allocated proportionally. How did Donald Trump's commanding victory last night position him in the delegate race moving forward?
Well, first of all, I would say it's a maybe not so long road after all. I mean, I think that this thing has been moved up significantly because the Trump campaign, which is more sophisticated this time than in 2016, has really been able to make a lot of efforts to move up states in the process that favor him with the kinds of processes that favor him. And by the end of March, we're going to see 70% of the delegates allocated. So we're talking about only a couple of months here. And when you look at, you have about a dozen states in that period of time that Kevin Madden was talking about that have winner take all if the person gets above 50%, meaning a state like California has 169 delegates. If Trump were to get over 50% like he did last night, he gets all of those delegates. That's new. That's something that the Trump campaign really pushed for. And when you look at those two dates that Kevin mentioned between March 5th and March 19th, there's over 1,200 delegates at stake just on those 2 weeks. And 1,215 is the magic number that somebody needs to get. And with all of these potentially winner-take-all states, I'm circling on my calendar March 23rd because March 19th, I'm calling winner-take-all Tuesday because they're finally going to be actually states saying whoever wins gets all the delegates then. And we may be talking about Trump wrapping up the nomination by the end of March.
Really? You know, Domenico, I think one of the most underreported stories of the Trump era has to do with the ways in which Donald Trump and his allies re-engineered the infrastructure of the Republican Party and installed MAGA acolytes and his supporters in key state positions. Many of them are state party chairs. Tell me more about that and how he is now capitalizing on it.
I mean, it's a hugely undercovered story. I mean, that he was able to hire people who really understand the delegate process and were doing this at times when people weren't really paying that much attention. Sure, the DeSantis campaign was trying to ramp up. They had people who were trying to influence this as well. But look, Trump is a quasi-incumbent. He's the former president. And while he was president, he installed a lot of loyalists within those state parties so that you wouldn't have something like what happened in 2016 on the floor of the convention where Ted Cruz and people who were associated with him could mount this kind of potential challenge. It didn't work, but Trump was like not wanting to have to see a repeat of some WWE-style moment that we all had to watch where Ted Cruz is coming down from the rafters. He was saying, no, I want this thing wrapped up. I want it wrapped up quickly. And they have pushed, they have leveraged almost everything that they can, you know, whether it's, you know, incentivizing people to go to Mar-a-Lago or Bedminster to be wined and dined or to be threatened with potential punishment if Trump does become president and to be iced out of the process.
Let's look ahead to New Hampshire. How well does Nikki Haley have to do in New Hampshire to have a reasonable argument for staying in the race?
I think a lot of people are saying she's going to have to win in New Hampshire, considering that she finished third place in Iowa. And I think it's going to be difficult for her to win in a place like South Carolina. I think she, if she finishes a reasonably close second place, considering that Trump has had, you know, a double-digit lead there, she can still make the argument that she needs to move on. But, you know, you got to look at the demographics of the electorate in New Hampshire. You're not going to have another state that's quite as moderate where Haley can sort of appeal to those voters because it's just not the majority of the Republican caucuses right now, Republican primary voters right now. You know, I mean, we saw last night in the entrance polls, two-thirds of Republican caucus goers said that they, you know, felt that even if Trump was convicted of a crime, that he would still be fit to be president. You had only 3 in 10 voters say that they thought Joe Biden was legitimately elected. I mean, that is not the profile of the kinds of voters that Nikki Haley can really appeal to and win out with.
Domenico Montanaro, senior political editor and correspondent for NPR. Thanks so much for coming in.
You're welcome.
In the day's other headlines, major snow and ice storms and bitter wind chills plagued much of the country again. In state after state, classes were canceled, planes were grounded, and homes were dark. Stephanie Tsai has our report.
After days of freezing cold and snow, major cities across the United States woke up to find schools and offices closed. More than 1,300 flights on the East Coast were canceled. For many places on the East Coast, including Manhattan, it's the first significant snowfall in years. New York had not seen more than an inch of snow in 701 days. Philadelphia has faced a similar snow drought.
My daughter's 4. She doesn't remember the snow, so this is her first time actually checking it out. So yesterday, I said, it might snow today, you guys. So when they woke up this morning, see snow all over the ground, they lost their minds.
In the country's interior, temperatures have stayed below freezing. A brief warm-up is predicted, but a new surge of cold air is expected by the end of the week. Wind chills in the Rockies, Great Plains, and Midwest plunged as low as negative 30 degrees.
Snow operations.
Austin Rouser is managing the snow removal in Omaha, Nebraska, where crews have been working overtime.
We've had a lot of people working 12-hour days for, you know, 9-10 days in a row. So it's been, obviously, that's a lot of time, it's a lot of effort, a lot of work, and a lot of dedication that our people have put into the snow.
In these dangerous conditions, he warns drivers to be vigilant.
The best thing for anybody to do in any location when conditions are bad is just to make sure that you have plenty of time to slow down, you know, understand how your vehicle operates differently. We can't slam on brakes when we've got ice on the road.
Farther south, snowplows cleared the roads during the winter storm warning in Tennessee. A layer of snow covered western Kentucky, and freezing rain created icy conditions in Alabama. But it wasn't all misery.
Our arsenal of snowballs.
With federal offices closed in Washington, D.C., the National Mall was for snow lovers who have waited 2 years for enough snow to put up a proper fight. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Stephanie Tsai.
So far, the Arctic wave is blamed for at least 7 deaths nationwide, and a new ice storm is moving into the Pacific Northwest and heading east. The top tax policymakers in Congress announced a bipartisan agreement today to expand the child tax credit and restore a variety of breaks for businesses. The package totals roughly $78 billion, paid for by ending a pandemic-era business credit. Lawmakers are pushing to win passage before tax filing season kicks off. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky made an urgent new appeal today for help against Russia. He met with U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and others at the World Economic Forum in Switzerland. And he warned against letting war fatigue undermine Kyiv's cause.
If anyone thinks this is only about us, this is only about Ukraine, they are fundamentally mistaken. If one must fight against Putin together in the years ahead, isn't it better to put an end to him and his war strategy now?
Meanwhile, in Moscow, Russian President Vladimir Putin declared his forces have regained momentum in the war, and he insisted Russia will not give up any territorial gains in Ukraine. Back in this country, the killer of five people at an LGBTQ nightclub in Colorado has pleaded not guilty to federal hate crimes charges. Anderson Aldrich has admitted shooting patrons of Club Q in Colorado Springs in November of 2022. Aldrich pleaded guilty to state murder charges last year. The federal charges carry a possible death penalty. A federal judge in Boston blocked JetBlue Airways today from buying Spirit Airlines. The Justice Department had sued to block the merger of low-cost carriers worth $3.8 billion. Today, the judge agreed it would hurt competition and drive up fares. Wall Street had a lackluster day following the holiday weekend. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 232 points to close at 37,361. The Nasdaq fell 28 points, and the S&P 500 slipped nearly 18. And the 75th Primetime Emmy Awards are now history, with some historic firsts. Quinta Brunson won Best Actress in a Comedy, Abbott Elementary. She's the first black woman to do that in more than 40 years. And Ali Wong became the first Asian American Best Actress in a Limited Series for her role in Beef. Overall, the final season of HBO's Succession won 6 awards last night, and The Bear, about a struggling Chicago sandwich joint, won Best Comedy. Still to come. On the News Hour, Donald Trump appears in court for the defamation case brought by writer E. Jean Carroll. A new book explores how populist politicians have transformed the Democratic Party. A group of students take it on themselves to address the growing mental health needs in schools, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
The Biden administration will soon designate Houthi militants in Yemen as a specially designated global terrorist group, a White House official tells the NewsHour. It follows more than 30 Houthi attacks on commercial shipping in the Red Sea. And it's a reversal from the first days of the Biden administration when the U.S. delisted the Houthis as a foreign terrorist organization. Earlier today, Israel and Hamas agreed to allow more medicine into Gaza, both for Gazans and for the more than 100 Israelis still held hostage. But attacks in the last 24 hours in Lebanon and Iraq have caused Middle East and U.S. officials to voice concerns about the risks of a wider war. Nick Schifrin reports.
Not doing!
Across the region tonight, fears of escalation. Today, Israel launched one of its largest salvos against Hezbollah in Lebanon since October the 7th. Just yesterday, a mother and son were buried together, killed on Sunday by a Hezbollah missile. In northern Iraq, Iran launched a rare ballistic missile attack on what it said was a local office of Israel's spy agency. But among the dead was a Kurdish multimillionaire and his family killed in their home. And off the coast of Yemen, U.S. warships launched the third round of strikes on the Houthis in 6 days. The target today, 4 Houthi ballistic missiles before they could be fired. The Houthis welcome war and once again today launched a missile the U.S. military said struck a Maltese flag ship that was able to sail away.
What we have right now in the region is a recipe of escalation everywhere.
3,000 miles away at the World Economic Forum, leaders from the region and National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan acknowledged concerns of wider war.
We have to guard against and be vigilant against the possibility that, in fact, rather than heading towards de-escalation, we are on a path of escalation that we have to manage.
Purposely or not, Hamas's October 7th terrorist attack accelerated existing tensions. And today, de-escalation runs through Gaza, said Sullivan and Qatari Prime Minister Mohammed Al-Thani.
We should focus on the main conflict in Gaza. And as soon as it's diffused, I believe everything else will be diffused.
But the spark and smoke of the war in Gaza continues to spread. Today, in central Gaza's Nusrat refugee camp, families carted all they had left. The UN says Gazans are stalked by the long shadow of starvation. Today in Rafah, Mohammed Al-Shandogli waited for food with his children.
Our bodies are ill. My children are ill due to lack of food. This is not enough.
Despite Israel's campaign, today Palestinian militants fired more than 24 rockets into Israel, the highest number in more than a week. And a reminder of how far Israel is from achieving its military goals. But there is disunity on how to achieve those goals.
Hamas.
Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu wants to continue the war until Hamas is destroyed. War cabinet member and opposition leader Benny Gantz is willing to stop if it comes with the release of more than 100 hostages.
Happy birthday! Bring them home now!
There is a reminder of the hostages' absence every day. Today is Kafir Bibas' first birthday. He and his family were taken from their home 102 days ago. Hamas says they were killed in an Israeli airstrike, but his extended family holds out hope he survived to see his second year.
As for that agreement between Israel and Hamas to allow more medicine into Gaza, it was negotiated by Qatar. Netanyahu said today that two Qatari Air Force planes will fly to Egypt tomorrow to deliver medicine, both for Israeli hostages and millions of Gazans who need it. For more on the direction of Israel's war in Gaza, as well as the splits within the Israeli war cabinet, we turn to David Makovsky, distinguished fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, former journalist, and was a senior advisor for Israeli-Palestinian negotiations during the Obama administration. David Makovsky, thanks very much.
Welcome. Delighted to be with you.
Welcome back to NewsHour. As we just said, there's a split in the war cabinet when it comes to hostages. It appears that Netanyahu and Defense Minister Yoav Gallant on one side, Benny Gantz on the other. What's behind that, and how significant is it?
Look, I think it's very important. It's one of the two big conceptual debates in the five-member war cabinet. Basically, the Netanyahu-Gallant school says the way to get the hostages is to put more military pressure in this war. The more you dig under the tunnels in Khan Yunis in southern Gaza, where it is believed that Mohammed Deif and Yahya Sinwar are located, the leaders of Hamas are located, the better you have a chance of securing their release. The other school is of the centrists, who happen to be two former IDF Israeli military chiefs of staff, pride themselves on their pragmatism. Benny Gantz, you mentioned, another Gadi Eisenkot, who lost his son, by the way, in this war. Yeah. And the two of them say, look, it's 102 days now with these hostages. You don't have all the time in the world. And the best way to secure the release is to cut a deal with Egypt, Qatar, whoever that may be. And then if that involves some sort of extended pause, so be it. You could always renew hostilities at a later time, but if in terms of what to prioritize, hostages of the war, the priority should go to the hostages.
The second big division within the war cabinet, as you mentioned, is between Netanyahu and Gallant, the defense minister. Yesterday, Gallant said that Palestinians will govern Gaza in the future, something Netanyahu has not said. And then he took a not-so-subtle swipe. He said, quote, political indecision may harm the progress of the military operation. What's he saying?
So I think here, Gallant is saying, you know, we can't just kick the can down the road about what does post-war look like. Let's be real. The Palestinian Authority should come back. They governed Gaza from 94 to 2007 until Hamas kind of threw them off of rooftops in 2007 until this war. So the defense establishment wants the PA to come back. The prime minister, however, is very fearful that Gantz and Eisenkot, the centrists that enlarged his government after the October 7th atrocities, that they will walk, that they will go for elections, and that he will be stuck with the people holding the balance of power, guess who? The hard right. And Mr. Smotrich, who was the finance minister, Ben-Gvir, who was the police minister and the like. So he doesn't seem to want to offend those two, because he might think the future of his government depends on these two guys. So he won't say the words PA. He won't say the words Palestinian Authority. He won't say the word Palestinian. He'll just say, let's see what the war looks like afterwards. Right now, we don't have to decide.
But this isn't only about politics, David, as you know, right? This is life and death for many people. This is the fate of the war itself, right? This is important.
Of course. I think the Secretary of State's visit to the region last week was, okay, look ahead a bit now. Are you going to allow, you know, people to go back to their homes in northern Gaza? You wanted to keep, you know, Palestinians from being killed. You told 1 million people go to the south. Okay, now you've, like, almost won the north. Not yet, but almost. Do you have a plan to bring them back to their homes? And if so, who's going to run public orders? You know, civilian services, basic services. And so I think what Gallant and Halevi are trying to tell Netanyahu is, hey, we can't just kick the can down the road. There are going to be some decisions we have to make sooner rather than later.
There is some genuine frustration in the Biden administration with Netanyahu himself. Is Netanyahu listening?
Not sure. I mean, I think the president in particular, who's wildly popular in Israel, I just came back. Every meeting starts with, thank you, Joe Biden. That it's very personal there, almost as if he's like the father of the country. He's viewed as someone who really cares about their security, and I think that's very important. But somehow that public support is not translated when he says, okay, Bibi, this is what I want you to do, which is there's certain tax transfers that you owe the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank. Yet here, I think Netanyahu is more concerned about political calculations, about the hard right. And I think the president is right to press the point with the prime minister.
As you were saying to me earlier, whenever President Biden or any U.S. official brings up two-state solution right now, it lands like a lead balloon. Do you think, quickly, there is a different way to talk about the two-state solution that the U.S. could find?
When we in America talk about two states, and some of us, for our lives, we want something that gives dignity to both sides, and I still think it's the right approach. But a lot of us, and in the administration, they assume that Palestinian state is going to look like Costa Rica. Yet with the Israelis here, two states, they say, look at the industrial capacity Hamas was able to do. By the way, without smuggling in things, their own industrial capacity, they see that state as looking more like North Korea. And therefore, we need to somehow talk about what sort of two-state solution we're talking about. And not just what the borders are going to be like, and I myself have worked on this issue, but how are we going to enforce it? Yeah, we say the word demilitarized, but the Israelis are convinced that Hamas will always outmuscle a more pragmatic Palestinian leadership to take it in a very different, more militant direction. And we got to feel there's got to be a way to talk about this in a way that we're talking about the same sort of two states. Because right now, us in the U.S. and them in Israel, we're just talking past each other.
David Makowski, always a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Fresh off his win in Iowa, former President Donald Trump spent time in a New York City courtroom. The trial that started today will decide how much he owes writer E. Jean Carroll for defaming her while he was president. Mr. Trump was already found liable for sexually abusing Carroll in the 1990s and then lying about her years later. William Brangham was in the courtroom and joins us now from New York. So, William, tell us what transpired in court today.
Jeff, today was jury selection. So 50 potential jurors were winnowed down to 9 jurors. And then Judge Lewis Kaplan gave instructions to those jurors today, and he was as crystal clear about what this case is really all about. He said this is not a do-over of that previous case. This is not a chance for Trump to get another bite at the apple, as he put it. He was very, very clear to the jury. He said that Donald Trump sexually assaulted E. Jean Carroll back in the 90s, and that he, very briefly but very graphically, he described what happened in that dressing room. He said then Trump defamed her when she came forward to say that this had happened. He said she lied about it, that he had never met her, and that she made this up to make money. And the judge said that Trump knew that those things were false when he said them. So that's not what this case is about. The judge said this case is about what is E. Jean Carroll owed for that defamation. And the striking thing about watching today's proceedings unfold is that in the previous times that we have seen Donald Trump in court, it is always Donald Trump against some governmental prosecutor, a special counsel, an attorney general of a state, a district attorney. Here, it was Donald Trump against this one woman who he violently sexually assaulted almost 30 years ago. And just seeing them in court, I mean, it's possible that this is the first time that they have been in the same room together since that assault almost 3 decades ago. And I watched E. Jean Carroll very closely for the 4 hours that they were together in the room. And only once did she sneak one slight sideways glance at him. And that was the extent of it today.
William, what is Ms. Carroll seeking from Donald Trump in terms of financial damages?
She's asking for $10 million for compensatory and punitive damages. She has already received $5 million from the previous case for the assault and for some defamation from Donald Trump from 2022 statements as he made. These are about statements he made while he was president. And E. Jean Carroll's lawyer referred to this as Donald Trump using the world's biggest megaphone to say that she was a liar, to say that she made all of these things up. And they're arguing that they want that money to basically salvage her ruined reputation for the emotional distress that she has suffered. They argue that Donald Trump's statements about her has unleashed this torrent of vile tweets. She showed many of them. Threats and statements about how she should be assaulted again by millions of Trump's followers. And they argue that they need to make him pay in order to force him to stop, because the former president has not stopped. I mean, just today alone, he has posted 30 different posts or reposts about E. Jean Carroll. Trump's defense to all of this is that to argue reputational damage from what the president, then president, said is ludicrous. They argue, and Trump's lawyer today said this, that E. Jean Carroll has thrived since she told this story. She's been on talk shows and doing interviews and is planning a documentary series, and that to try to blame two statements that the then president made for unleashing all of these, as they call them, bad trolls on the internet is inappropriate, and they're trying to punish him for no good reason.
And William, we know that Donald Trump did not show up in court for the first trial when a jury found him liable for sexual abuse and defamation. Why did he appear today?
Jeff, it's a very good question. It's legally hard to understand why he came to this trial, where he's already been found guilty on all of these major counts, and didn't come back when he could have potentially made a difference in that case. And I think, this, as many have noted, that this is all of these cases that Trump is involved with have just become part of his political campaign. I think he is hoping to create this montage of videos of him entering courtrooms all over New York and Florida and Washington, D.C. and Georgia to try to say, this is the deep state coming after me and interfering with me. In fact, tonight, about an hour ago, he posted a post on Truth Social saying, I would have preferred to have been in New Hampshire, but I had to be in this court with a Trump-hating judge on another political witch hunt. So again, I think legally the case is hard to make. Politically, I think that's what the former president is doing here.
William Brangham in New York City for us tonight. William, thank you.
My pleasure, Jeff.
Diabetics across the country will now see a break in their out-of-pocket costs for insulin. This month, Sanofi, one of the leading manufacturers of the hormone, joined two other major pharmaceutical companies in capping their insulin copays at $35. This comes after years of pressure by President Biden, lawmakers, and activists for companies to lower their list prices. White House correspondent Laura Barrón-López has been covering all this, and she joins me here now. Good to see you, Laura.
Good to be here.
So these insulin price caps for manufacturers this past month follow last year's insulin price caps for Medicare recipients that took effect. Tell us about the impact of both of these things together.
So what took effect this month was that Sanofi followed suit with Eli Lilly and Novo Nordisk to implement this cap on insulin copays at $35 that took effect January 1st. Now, that comes, as you noted, Amna, after the Medicare cap on insulin costs at $35 monthly for people. And that comes after President Biden also was pressuring these companies to do this, and after the provisions of the Inflation Reduction Act that he passed with those Medicare insulin caps took effect last year. Now, just to add some context about the full impact of this, I want to run through a few of the numbers about insulin in the United States. So in the U.S., around 8.4 million diabetics need to inject insulin to survive, according to the American Diabetes Association. The three major manufacturers we're talking about, Sanofi, Novo Nordisk, and Eli Lilly, who capped their copays at $35, make up more than 90% of the insulin market. And the Medicare provisions in the Inflation Reduction Act mean that now about 1.7 million Medicare beneficiaries stand to benefit from that $35 monthly copay cap on their insulin. So that shows the significance of what's been happening.
Millions of people, right, who have to worry about this. Are there still people who are still left out of coverage right now?
So this could impact a lot of people, but the key difference with what the manufacturers did between the Medicare provision is that the Medicare provision is automatic. That means that someone goes to a pharmacy, they're able to benefit from that $35 monthly dollar copay, whereas people who under private insurance or who are not insured, who don't have insurance, who may benefit from what the manufacturers did, it's not automatic. They have to register for programs, and it can become pretty complicated for them very quickly. And I spoke to Shayna Casper, policy director at T1 International. They advocate for insulin access. And she said that she's fearful that manufacturers could simply decide at any point, we're not going to provide this reduction in insulin cost, and that essentially, what needs to happen is a federal mandate, so that way these manufacturers, for uninsured patients, for people who have private insurance, can benefit from a cap on their insulin costs.
So, Laura, you mentioned that insulin cap for Medicare beneficiaries is part of President Biden's Inflation Reduction Act. Are there other health care measures that are taking effect this year or next that we should know about?
We've seen already two big ones take effect, Amna, the insulin copay caps and the free vaccines. But there's a lot more to come for Medicare beneficiaries. So I want to run through the timeline. Basically, 60 million people are covered under Medicare. And so this month, in January of 2024, prescription costs of certain drugs for Medicare recipients is going to be capped at $3,300 annually. And that's especially helpful for people with expensive medication for chronic conditions like arthritis and cancer. Then in September of this year, the new list prices of 10 major drugs are going to be made public. That was made possible by the Inflation Reduction Act's provision allowing Medicare to negotiate drug prices with manufacturers. And then by 2025, that annual cap on prescription costs will drop to $2,000. And in 2026, those new drug list prices that Medicare was allowed to negotiate will take effect, so people will start to feel it. Now, I spoke to Juliet Kubensky, the Deputy Director of Medicare Policy for KFF, and this is how she described the significance of those coming negotiated drug prices.
This has been for years a concern for policymakers, particularly Democrats, who thought, you know, Medicare should have the ability to negotiate drug prices with manufacturers. But prior to the Inflation Reduction Act, it was actually prohibited by law. So giving Medicare the ability to negotiate drug prices is meaningful because there are 60 million people covered by Medicare, and that's a lot of leverage that the federal government now has.
So when Juliet says for years that Democrats have been trying to pass a law that allows Medicare to negotiate drug prices, she's talking about going back decades to the George W. Bush administration when this was trying to get passed. And for those who are concerned about the deficit, she says this has an impact on that as well.
So the Congressional Budget Office estimated that Medicare would save around $300 billion over 10 years as a result of the changes in the Inflation Reduction Act. And much of that is due to the new negotiation program that Medicare is currently implementing. So Medicare will save money because the cost of drugs will be lower.
So what that means, Amna, is that Medicare costs for American taxpayers will also be lower, and it will as well be lower for Medicare patients.
So you've been digging into this and reporting all this to lay out all of these details. Do most people understand all of these changes? And I guess politically, is President Biden getting credit for this?
So the short answer, Amna, is that no, most people don't understand these changes that are occurring. And part of that may be because the Inflation Reduction Act was this big signature law that the president passed that includes also climate change provisions and a number of other elements that it appears, some Democrats say, is hard for the average voter to understand. But I spoke to Cornell Belter, a veteran Democratic pollster, who said that even more than a year after the Inflation Reduction Act was passed, voters still don't quite know what's in it.
The Biden campaign has tons of good stories to tell, from everything from historical environmental legislation to historical infrastructure legislation to historical negotiations with pharmaceutical companies. But again, the challenge is, and we're seeing that in with voters, is so many of them don't know and they're not connecting the dots.
Juliet Kubansky echoed that, Amna. And so this is something that the Biden campaign is going to have to address this year.
Well, do we plan to hear more from them on it? I mean, so far, the opening re-election campaign message has been largely about democracy. Will these issues be a bigger part of their message?
It is going to have to be a critical part of their message, Amna, particularly if the president is going to close that gap in voters' perceptions around the economy. So being able to lower healthcare costs in people's pocketbooks is going to be a part of that economic message. And they have spent tens of millions of dollars on TV ads and digital ads, some of which highlight the reduction in insulin caps, some of which highlight the ability for Medicare to negotiate drug prices. But still, Cornell said that they're going to have to do a lot more than just conventional TV ads.
So you've got to flood the box in a way that not even we had to do in 2012 or 2008, right? I think he's got to, the campaign's got to lean in to social media spaces harder and in a new way than I think we've ever had to in the past.
Ultimately, Amna, a lot of the Democratic lawmakers that I spoke to said that they want to see Biden make this message more in key battleground states as early as possible. The key difference, they said, between 2016 and Hillary Clinton's campaign and this election cycle and Joe Biden's campaign is that Democrats in battleground states say that Biden's campaign is actually heeding their warnings.
All right. That is our White House correspondent, Laura Barrón-López. Laura, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Between the House GOP's government funding fight and former President Donald Trump's hold on the Republican Party, much has been made of the far right's strong sway over the GOP and its agenda. But what doesn't get nearly as much attention is the far left's influence in the Democratic Party. I sat down last week with Joshua Green to discuss just that. It's the focus of his latest book called The Rebels: Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and the Struggle for a New American Politics. Joshua Green, welcome to the NewsHour.
Good to be with you. Thanks.
In the book, you trace the rise of the modern-day progressive movement to the 2008 financial crisis. How was that a clarifying moment and a catalyst for progressive politics and progressive politicians?
I mean, to me, the 2008 crash and its aftermath was the defining event in recent U.S. political history, and then it gave rise to this furious populist backlash on the right, which eventually gave rise to Donald Trump, but also on the left, which gave rise to my characters. First, Elizabeth Warren, then Bernie Sanders, who nearly succeeded in winning the Democratic nomination in 2016, and then ultimately to this new generation of younger progressives, such as Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and the cohort around her in Congress.
You mentioned Elizabeth Warren, and in the book you explore how she ultimately emerged at the center of the government's response to the financial crisis. And, you know, at the time, she was an unlikely voice in that regard. Walk us through her evolution based on your reporting.
Yeah, Warren is a fascinating figure. I got to know her just after the crisis. She was still a Harvard law professor, but she had just been appointed one of the overseers of the government's bailout of Wall Street after the crash. And she used that fairly obscure position as a platform to really go after the Obama administration, the banks, and articulate this version of left-wing populism that really hadn't had a voice in recent American political history. It wound up catching fire, really starting a movement. And within a few years, even before she ran for Senate in 2012, people in Washington would talk about the Elizabeth Warren wing of the Democratic Party. So it helped give rise to this new brand of progressivism that we saw rise up in the wake of the crisis.
And fast forward to the current moment, how do you view the progressive influence on President Biden's agenda? Because you could argue that he has governed like an economic populist, and in many ways far less than the centrist Democrat that he was expected to be given his long track record.
Which is really a remarkable evolution. I mean, when I first came to Washington as a reporter in 2000, Biden was a senator from Delaware, was known as a great friend of business, was sometimes jokingly referred to as the senator from corporate America. I think Biden's evolution in particular has been an interesting one because he was in the White House with Barack Obama as his vice president when that first crash hit. And then when he was elected president, inherited another great economic crash that followed the COVID pandemic. And the response to those two crashes, I think, illustrates what an effect these populists have had. After COVID, Biden put in place multiple rounds of stimulus, unemployment benefits, student loan freezes, small business loans, but all of it focused it on the middle class in a way that hadn't necessarily been true of the response to the 08 crisis. And so when you hear Biden speak today about the economy, he talks about building it from the middle out. He shows up on union picket lines. He does things that would have been fairly unimaginable for a centrist Democrat to do, 10, 15, or 20 years ago.
What is it about the Democratic brand of populism that's different from the kind of populism that Trump supporters prefer?
Well, the populism that I write about with Warren, Bernie, and Ocasio-Cortez is really focused on economic populism. And I think my last book, Devil's Bargain, was about the rise of Steve Bannon, Donald Trump, and right-wing populism. And mostly, I think that's focused on a kind of cultural populism, a lot of anger toward immigration, America first nationalism. Certainly, there are some economic components. Trump is very hawkish toward trade. He put in place steel tariffs that the Biden administration has kept in place. There are areas of overlap, but to me, it's the cultural element that distinguishes the right-wing populism from the left-wing populism that I write about in this book.
What about the politicians themselves? Is there a ceiling of support for progressive candidates? Democrats who might support progressive policies, there hasn't been enough support from the Democratic base to propel one of the progressive politicians into the White House.
It's an interesting question, because if you go back to 2019, I was embedded with Warren and with Sanders for a time during the Democratic primaries when they were both running for president. It seemed like in the moment that progressive politics was really taking off, and yet neither one of them emerged as a Democratic nominee, partly because there were two of them running and they split the progressive vote. But really, I think there is a ceiling on candidates who are explicitly defined as left-wing progressives in Democratic primaries. It's really only in deep blue places like Ocasio-Cortez's district in New York and a few other places where these true left-wing progressives, Democratic socialists, have been able to get themselves elected. But we've seen in a lot of races since then, in Democratic primaries and general elections, that they try and they fail. So one of the arguments I make in the book is the future of this brand of progressivism may not be through these particular politicians, but through politicians like Joe Biden, who kind of code as more moderate, as more centrist, but who still take up and put into place a lot of the politics that my characters gave rise to.
The book is The Rebels, Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and the Struggle for a New American Politics. Joshua Green, thanks for coming in. Good to talk to you.
Thanks so much, Jeff. Appreciate it.
Mental health among the nation's student population has been a growing concern, especially coming out of the COVID-19 pandemic. Many states are trying to make sure there are adequate resources for schools' needs. From PBS Wisconsin, Stephen Potter reports on how peer support, school staff, and psychology researchers are trying to keep up with the growing rate of mental health issues among K-12 students in Wisconsin. It's part of our series, Early Warnings, America's Youth Mental Health Crisis.
I think every school principal would love to have more mental health professionals.
Despite having a handful of counselors, a school psychologist, and a social worker on staff, Andy Farley, principal of Brookfield East High School, says they still have trouble meeting the mental health needs of their 1,400 students.
It's never going to be enough.
Farley knows firsthand how devastating student mental health problems can become. A few years back, a number of students at Brookfield East High School died from suicide.
Incredibly difficult at our school level, incredibly difficult at our community level. We all knew we had to do something.
They created a local chapter of the National Student-Led Mental Health Support Network called the Hope Squad.
Does anyone want to share out about some of the positives?
On a weekly basis, the school's 60 student members discuss new strategies to help their classmates stay mentally healthy, from the importance of getting enough sleep and social-emotional learning techniques to recognizing suicide warning signs. Brookfield East sophomore Leidra Ashenbrenner is a Hope Squad member.
From a student standpoint, we are like the eyes and the ears of the school. We bridge the gap between students and counselors and teachers because like research has shown that students are more likely to go to their peers if they're having like an issue with that they need help with.
20% of kids have some type of behavioral or social emotional concern.
Katie Eklund is a professor of school psychology at UW-Madison.
But we know out of that group, only 20% of those kids actually receive that support.
Eklund works to find solutions to the increasing rates of young children suffering from anxiety and depression, including those harming themselves or considering suicide.
Unmet mental health concerns we see often by the time kids get to high school. We see kids not coming to school. We see lower grades. We see higher incidence in the juvenile justice system and just lower, you know, poor psychosocial outcomes throughout life, progress throughout elementary school.
Eklund says that children aren't getting the help they need because of a shortage of mental health professionals, such as therapists, counselors, and school psychologists. According to the National Center for Education Statistics, 70% of public schools say more students are seeking mental health services. But 87% of those schools say they can't provide such services to all of the students in need. Eklund and her colleagues, however, have a plan and new resources to address this shortage with a $10 million grant from the U.S. Department of Education.
It's designed to increase the pipeline of school psychologists, school social workers, and school counselors who are working in K through 12 schools around the country.
She says the need speaks for itself.
In 2018, we had 60 to 70 unfilled positions across the state of school psychologists. We anticipate that school social workers and counselors are experiencing similar shortages, both here in the state and across the country, and that those shortages have only increased over the last 5 years.
And while everyone from school administrators to the students themselves agree that more mental health professionals are needed in schools, they would still need to be paid, and that's where the state legislature could come in.
Democratic State Representative Robin Vining has introduced a package of bills aimed at increasing funding for K-12 mental health services. She says we're well past the time for action.
We know there's a mental health care crisis. We know that. And so we cannot look away. I don't believe that we can move forward right now without acting on mental health care.
One of Representative Vining's bills would increase spending on mental health care services in the state's school system by $100 million per year.
We're talking about children who are experiencing anxiety, depression, suicidality, and we're trying to get professionals to be available to work with them, to help them survive this very difficult stage of life.
And so, at the local, state, and national level, Wisconsin is working to respond to the growing mental health needs of its youngest populations. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Stephen Potter in Brookfield, Wisconsin.
And that's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Jeff Bennett.
And I'm Amna Nawaz. On behalf of the entire NewsHour team, thank you for joining us.